Lying Awake stands in solidarity with the movement for Black Lives. Throughout today's episode, we will be highlighting artist organizations that seek to dismantle white supremacy in American theater by fostering environments of accountability in all areas of the theater-making process. We hope that this will provide resources for our listeners to learn more about what actions they can take to help make this world a more just, informed, and loving place. We will not be doing our usual artist and production spotlights this episode to make room for these highlights. Please consider giving your time and resources to these organizations. Hello, anyone and everyone, and welcome back to Lying Awake, a theater podcast. My name is John Arlen Baines. My co-host Alex Price is not with us this episode. This podcast was born during periods of stagnation in both our lives, and now that things are beginning to pick back up, and he's in the middle of a crazy full couple of weeks. So it's just me and you today. Kind of. We're joined by incredible guests. I can't wait for you to meet them. We have two directors from two different parts of the country who do amazing work. They also hold very dear places in my heart, and I haven't seen their faces in a number of years, so I'm super excited. I hope you are too. Let's wake up and meet them. First up, we have Emil Thomas. Now, I typically write the bios for our guests and seek their final okay at the end, but Emil's bio on his theater company's website, Marietta's New Theater in the Square in Marietta, Georgia, is a warm and impressive introduction to him. So I'm going to read it almost straight through. And Emil Thomas is a Southern gentleman with a New York attitude, raised in a family of New York Ricans in the quiet streets of Cobb County, Georgia. Emil learned early the value of time and space. His love for theater began in middle school, where he was introduced to musical theater first. He continued to play on the stage in high school when he attended Cobb County School for Excellence in the Performing Arts. By the end of his sophomore year in high school, Emil knew that he wanted to move from acting to directing. So he traveled to Muncie, Indiana, where he studied under the leadership of Karen Kessler at Ball State University as an undergrad directing student. In 2016, Emil was invited to the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival for directorial work in Region 3. With the support of his family, Emil reopened Marietta's Theater in the Square with one goal in mind: to create theater for the 21st century that is inclusive of all. In the fall of 2016, Emil reached out to graduating colleagues with an opportunity to create their own theater company, and at last, Actors Theater of Georgia was born. Emil and his team have created seasons that embody theater for all, from a gender-swapped Hamlet, which I was lucky enough to see and was awesome, to his adaptation of O. Henry's classic tale, The Gift of the Magi 2.0, set in Atlanta during the 1950s Atlanta streetcar strike. This 2017 production was nominated for 5 Metropolitan Atlanta Theater Awards. He's directed the Southeast regional premieres of Carmen Rivera's La Gringa, Tanya Barfield's Bright Half Life, and Nambi E. Kelly's Native Son, which featured an appearance from Nambi herself and won Atlanta's Broadway World Best Play and Director for 2017. In summer 2018, Emil relocated to Chicago to further develop his craft of directing. He currently studies at the theater school at DePaul University to receive his master's in directing. His most recent production, Partners, a stage play, is one that he wrote, directed, designed, and produced himself this month, June 2020. It was a two-person modern romance performed live each night, and the live performance was streamed for ticket holders to tune into. I watched it from my couch last week, and it made me feel hopeful and frightened and lonely and brave. Emil, thank you for finding a way to make theater while theaters are closed down, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. What a freaking introduction, man. I appreciate that. It's going to be fun.
Good. All right. Karen Kessler is here with us today, and her credits are so numerous that if I read them all, I think I would give myself vocal nodules. So I'm going to try. Firstly, she has been an ensemble member at a Red Orchid Theater in Chicago since 2007, where she most notably directed the world premiere of Brett Neveu's The Opponent in 2012, which she later moved to the off-Broadway theater 59E59 in 2014. At Red Orchid, she also directed numerous other Chicago premieres, such as Jennifer Haley's The Nether, very spooky play, Zinni Harris's Solstice, Paul Mullen's Louis Slotin Sonata, and the U.S. premiere of Gagarin's Way by Scottish playwright Gregory Burke. But her career in Chicago is far from confined to a Red Orchid theater. She has directed all around town for venues such as Backstage Theater Company, Shaunakee Theater Company, the Midwest premiere of Sam Shepard's The God of Hell at Next Theater in Evanston, the Goodman Theater's world-renowned new play series, and the world premiere of the stage adaptation of Margaret Atwood's Alias Grace at the theater company she co-founded the Rivendell Theater Ensemble, which I was fortunate to see back in 2017 when I lived two blocks from Rivendell. She is also the former artistic director of Famous Door Theater in Chicago. We're still going, which became defunct in 2005, where she directed several more U.S. and world premieres, such as Early and Often, A Going Concern, This Lime Tree Brower, Remembrance, and Mislaid Heaven, which won a Jeff Award for Best New Work. She also has numerous credits all around the country at the Notre Dame and Illinois Shakespeare Festivals, and even a production of Glengarry Glen Ross for the Northern Stage Ensemble in Newcastle upon Tyne, England. Now, how does my ass know this directorial behemoth, you ask? Well, I met her during my time at Ball State University, where she somehow finds the time to be a full professor of directing and Shakespeare. And I was lucky enough to be in two of her shows, which contrasted most of the works that I listed in that they were big, pretty musicals. Guys and Dolls and The Music Man. It was a pleasure learning from her, and making her laugh is one of the greatest feelings in the world.
Kessler. Hi, hello, how are you? That makes me seem real old. Again, start listing all of that stuff, I sound real old.
You sound awesome.
I like big, pretty musicals. I like dark, depressing plays, and I like real pretty musicals.
Fantastic.
The first organization we'd like to highlight is We See You White American Theater, or WAT. We See You WAT is a collective formed by Black, Indigenous, and people of color theater makers made up of multi-generational, multidisciplinary, early career, emerging and established artists, theater managers, executives, students, administrators, dramaturgs, and producers to address the scope and pervasiveness of anti-Blackness and racism in the American theater. There is no leader of this body of like-minded theater creators, no one spokesperson. This is a broad collective built out of a deep love for the theater and a commitment to its evolution. To learn more and sign the petition, now nearly 79,000 signatures strong, visit www.wecuwat.com.
Okay, so our first segment is called Origins and Journeys. We've heard your amazing, stupendous resumes, but let's do a deeper dive and find out how all of this came to pass. Emil, let's start with you because I have so many questions.
Okay.
So you attended Cobb County School for Excellence in the Performing Arts. That was the literal name of your high school. And I have no idea about anything what going to a high school with that name is like. And all I can picture in my head is like the Fame movie and Glee. And so will you please give us a snapshot of what your high school experience was like?
My high school experience was definitely a small form of Glee and Fame. It was a half high school that was just traditionally district students, and then they added a magnet school into it and built a separate building, and that had a theater and all our classrooms, and so all the performing arts kids were in there. And and early on in high school, we didn't like the separation of the two of us, the district to the performing arts. And so we became a class that was really about, like, you know, exploring all forms of our youth in terms of football and cheerleading and the music of cheerleading, having performing arts kids in it. And our step team had performing arts kids. We really just, like, went all around and really immersed ourselves in as much of the culture of what high school would be, along with getting trained every day in acting, acting myself. I got directing training as the first student there. There was dancing, there was choir. So I was in the chorus for 3 years, made it to the chamber, figured out how to read music because I enjoyed musicals and thought that was important. Yeah. And then I dipped and went straight to directing and stayed with directing because I knew that was the way for me to be.
So are all of these things, acting, singing, directing, dancing, all of these are on top of core subjects, or is it like a conservatory college where that's just what you did all day, every day?
No, it's on top of your core classes.
Oh my goodness.
So we had extended days. I was there at 8:30 every day, and I was leaving there. The school ended at 4:30 for us. We had an extra period. But most of us had rehearsals after that, and we will be in rehearsals till 9-10 o'clock every day.
Oh my goodness. And you slept? Never.
Never slept. So going to college was, you know, it was an extension. It really is. It's crazy, but it really is a pre college prep for you, because the amount of time you're spending on this craft and getting just your work done really begins to equal how much time you're going to be spending in college, plus more.
And your life. Moving and on from college. And then your life.
Shenanigans.
Shenanigans.
Yeah. When was there time for math homework? That's crazy. So then what in turn turned your sights to Ball State and then to Paul?
Originally, Ball State was on my list of one of four directing programs that I was interested in.
Okay.
And there really wasn't that many undergrad directing programs. Like, in the last couple of years, there's been a very large influx of directing programs in undergrad. But in our time, there were still few. And Ball State had it, what you would consider an OG program, because it had been established and been around and had multiple cycles of students go through it.
Okay.
And I'm OG.
And she's the OG. Karen was the OG.
Did you help create the program, Karen?
Great. Yes, you did.
I did.
Wow.
I created the program. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. That's so cool.
She sure did. Which is beautiful, because what you end up doing, and we'll talk about this later, but one of the things I love about directing is the lineage of training. And if you know, I couldn't work with Meisner. He wasn't teaching anymore.
Right.
My goal was to get an OG that I was going to be the first generation after, so that I can grow a direct lineage of my work.
Wow.
What drew me to Ball State was I went to Unifieds and did the acting, and because I was an actor back then, I thought that was smart. And I got in for acting. I was originally a BFA actor at Ball State for the first 3 weeks of the first quarter. And Drew Vidal took me out of acting one day and said, "You are not supposed to be in here. Go talk to Karen Kessler."
Wow.
And they sent me like I was in high school again to the principal's office. And I went and I met Karen Kessler. And within that next week, I was in directing courses.
Wow.
So, and that was it. And I was hurt. Yeah, I never looked back. Wow. I tried to fight it. I tried to fight it. And I only say it because, again, there was still this mindset that you weren't going to be a director till you were 30.
Mm.
So it was, if I go with acting first and learn how to be an actor and then study directing, then I'm going to have that twofold that I need to be the artist I want to be when I'm going to blossom.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been blessed that over and over again, I have people in my life that are like, "Stop wasting time. Just do it now." you keep talking about a change and you are the change. So like, you have to do it.
Hell yeah.
Or else we're not going to be here.
So he's cool. Also just a natural director. I mean, you get people who come into a program. It's true about actors. It's true about writers. It's true about dramaturgs. It's true about... Emil was just a natural director. He just was. He understands text. He understands it. He wants to tell stories in a way directors like to tell stories. So.
What's it like to hear that?
It's like a kid when you get approval.
Don't need my approval, dude.
But she's my colleague now, which is the best part that I, you know.
Yeah.
But it's true. It's true, and I can say it's true only because as I get older, I listen more to the other side as much as I listen to what's in me.
Mm.
And so, you know, I think the one thing we don't do as directors as much as we should is we really boast up our work. We create things that really takes an orchestra. And when there's not an orchestra, it can be good, but there's work where you go, that's a director's piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say coming out of this, the training with Ball State and then immediately having to practice that and then going to Chicago showed me more than ever.
Yeah.
And the influx of work that's done in Chicago, you can tell what is being done by an artist with a vision and a method behind their work versus a company that's just putting work together because they can.
Got you. One more question for you in this section. Your bio says that you reopened Marietta's Theater in the Square, where you currently serve as executive artistic director. So can you tell us that story. Who owned it before? How did it close? And what was it like helming the reopening process? Like, what did you need? The expenses? Anything?
Yeah. So Theater in the Square closed in 2008 during the recession, the first one of our lifetime. Okay. And it had just went through a multi-million-dollar renovation. The theater was there for 30 years. It was an equity house. It had two spaces. The main space was majority for the company. The backstage space was like a 50-seater small black box, something you would see a lot in storefront Chicago spaces. Mm-hmm. And that's where they allowed all the black artists to perform their shows. So the White House, the front house was the White House, and the back house was the Black House.
Oh my God.
And they had their salt and pepper. I'm not going to tell you, they never did one. They did like one or two, and they, you know, they're chosen. But in 30 years, they didn't do anything. So they closed in 2008 after the recession hit, and they did that big remodel because they couldn't reopen. And it sat there for a couple of years. People tried to reopen it, hadn't been successful at it. I am preparing for graduation. It is November. I'm almost done. I'm finishing up my last of the classes. And I get a call from my father, and he says, I did something. And I said, okay, what'd you do? He said, I did something. And I said, okay, what is it, man? What'd you do? And he's like, remember that theater in the square that's been closed? And I said, yeah. He said, I invested in the theater. I said, what do you mean you invested? He said, I got us this theater. I invested in it. And so it's a week before Thanksgiving break. So I tell Karen, I say, my dad said he got a theater. I don't really know what this means, but I'm going to go home and see it. And when I come back, we may have to talk. I go home. I see it. It is the space. And I literally look around and I go, if I can make anything I want in here, I will be a fool not to go back, not to come back and do it right now.
Wow.
It's literally putting work to action. And in my head, I went, we're all graduating and none of us are promised a job either. So, you know, this is honestly something that can be a great start for our class. I go back to Karen and I say, it's not fake, it's real. and I showed her pictures, and she looked at me and she said, you got to go back. Karen told me before, I didn't ask, Karen told me, she's like, you have to go back. You got to go start this thing.
Wow.
And I had finished all my core classes. And so it was like, it was heaven sent that I was able to just pick up. And the last requirement was that I had to go to KCACTF, and I had to complete KCATF for the directing class.
And what did you do at KCACTF? What'd you do at KCACTF?
And then I went to KCTF and I brought the win home for Boston.
I want to point that out.
Yes. Yes. and it was beautiful because it was a great opportunity for me to finish as a college kid, because I jumped into adult life really quickly. My first production, which was an internship for the school, was Next to Normal. And we spent $700 on the set. The rights were almost $5,000.
Musical rights are always expensive.
Crazy.
Right. And people don't ever want to talk about it, but it's a big portion of your budget.
And is that a flat rate, or is that by weekend or performance, or that's...
Rights are usually by how much money you'll earn, the potential amount of money you can earn on the show. If they're professional rights, if they're amateur rights, that's a little bit of a different situation. But professional rights are a formula of seats to ticket prices to, so it's, but it's based on your potential earnings.
Okay, thank you.
And there is a per performance rate that they cut. And then you have to multiply that by the amount of shows you choose to do.
Right.
And then we paid, I honestly say we paid our actors $300. Like, it was a stipend. It wasn't even a payment. It was a stipend. We called it stipends. And it was a hot ass mess. It was a hot ass mess.
Why?
It was hot ass mess because I was, I was putting on a show that I knew well, right? Partly I knew well because we had just done it the semester before. Mm-hmm. And so I saw and I was like, okay, this is something you can actually do for cheap. Mm-hmm. And it's a musical and people want to see musicals. I'm a play person, but I knew business-wise, people want to see musicals. Mm-hmm. And so it was awful. I didn't have a true idea of what lighting design look like or how to describe lighting, lighting. Also, mm-hmm. I did it with a multiracial cast. And so I had never experienced casting a black person. I'm black, but I'd never had to light myself, right? So I said, I'm going to do this. And then I didn't know how to light color people and people of color. And then I was in, and then sound design with mics. I mean, we had a sound system that was in it. It's not the sound system we had now, right? But it was like, it was just mm-hmm. what we had.
Sure.
And that's the thing. You do what you have. You make the most of it, you sell it at that price point, and then you have to build yourself up. And so it just became a cycling of like, do a show, and whatever that profit is, it's investment plus profit, do it again. And you have to continue to multiply. And it's like, if I got, okay, this show showed you can get 30 people in the seats for 2 weeks. So that's eight shows. So you can afford eight shows at 50 seats or 30 seats. That's what you've done. Sure. Your next goal is you have to do 60 seats and add at least two more shows to that. And then your profit is now multiplying. And so now you have a larger profit, and then larger profit it goes, because here's the other thing. I'm a for-profit, not a non-for-profit.
Gotcha.
So because I'm a for-profit, I'm literally looking at how to multiply my liquid funds mm-hmm. so that I can do more shows.
Yeah.
I'm not looking at how do I get a grant and wait the year of the grant to do the production.
Right.
I'm just flipping the model over and over. And so, and flipping the model, we've had there for 5 years. It took us a couple of years to get to a point where we can play, four numbers.
He's yelling at his dog. For those of you who can't hear him, he's now yelling at his dog.
So sorry. But it's
I will I will probably have to yell at my dog later too, so it's okay.
But it took us years to get, our production value up,
yeah.
to get the quality of actors up, because, you have to pay actors more. And so, it was really scary. We were in a place, we were on our fifth season before COVID. And in our fifth season, we were doubling our actor pay. We have made it to that point where we were going to be able to just double the production value again, because we were doing it right and over, and we really had the system down. And then COVID came, and it's like, not only was like, all that is gone, you're not doubling, you're going back to where you were.
Sure.
But then it's also like, you got to go back to where you are and create something completely new.
Yeah.
I think it's the other thing I want to add to what Emil's saying there, that he started talking about in terms of having to learn how to light BIPOC people and all those kind of things you have to learn. He's talking about as a producer, but he's also, when you're starting out, you're teaching yourself to direct, because you learn a bunch of stuff at school, but you don't, in practice, when it's just you and you don't have a faculty member to go talk to, and when it's just you, you're having to take the skills you've learned, the toolbox you've been given, and you have to learn to use it. And so this maniacal thing he did, running a theater and learning to be a professional director, which both of which he did, that's just crazy talk. I mean, it's just crazy talk that he did that all at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, part of my admiration for what Emil's done here is not just that he's such a talented director, but it's also, he goes, okay, well, I'll try that. See what happens. And he's I'm not saying he's fearless, I'm saying he does not let fear stop him.
Hell yes.
And he does not let adversity stop him. And it's one of the reasons I admire his work so much, is because, and this is him as a human being, is because he doesn't let hard get in his way. Mm-hmm. He just keeps battering at it until he figures it out, which again is a trait directors have. where you just kind of have to keep saying, okay, no, how do I make that work? Okay, that didn't work. How do I make it work? You know, and you, it's a natural thing that directors, whether they're introverts or extroverts, I mean, obviously Emil and I are both extroverts, but there's introverted directors who have the exact same impulse. Mm-hmm. All right, that didn't work. How do I solve the problem? And it's astonishing that he was able to do everything he was able to do with that theater.
For those who don't know, the acronym Karen used at the beginning when she started talking, BIPOC, stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. So Karen of House Kessler, ninth of her name, queen of the Andals, and okay. First things first, the question on everyone's mind. How do you feel about internet memes taking your name in vain so flagrantly?
You know what? At first, I have to say, at first I was just like, ah, crap. Now my name is going to be a meme. I saw one that was super funny. And once I saw one that was super funny, I'm like, I can live with that because it's not me. You know, it's not me. When I argue politics on Twitter, I often will, if I have enough characters left, I'll often say, and yes, my name is Karen. I will write that. But I think we can safely say I'm pretty screamingly liberal. And I am not the Karens of whom most of those memes speak. And it's a word. It's not me. It's a label that I am identified by, and I know who I am.
Oh, good. And
I also know, in the middle of all of this stuff, the great thing about having a meme that includes your name is it keeps you honest, because I have to make sure, was I just being a Karen? I have to say that to myself sometimes. Was I just assuming something? And yeah, that, to me, that's what it is. It's, am I assuming something? Am I, as a white person, using my privilege? Am I, and for me, through this whole thing, in terms of the other thing that's happening in our world right now, but you know, in a big part of my last 10 years in terms of just dealing with my art that way, and when we started getting really serious about inclusivity and making sure we were creating stories and theaters and worlds for everybody, that one of my biggest questions for myself is to honestly ask myself every time it flares up, check your privilege. Am I using my privilege to get something? Mm-hmm. And so the Karen meme kind of actually helps me, because it's just a constant reminder not to be a Karen.
Way you know? More beautiful and self-aware answer to that silly question than I thought was coming. So thank you for that. Thank you for that.
Nobody should be a Karen. Nobody if we can help it.
Unless you're Karen Kessler. All right. So your career is insane. I don't know where to begin. Let's start from the beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in Crawfordsville, Indiana.
Really?
I was born in Indiana, and I found my way back to Indiana by the weirdest stretch of, you know, imagination. I found my way back to, I'm a Chicago girl. I consider myself, Chicago is my home. But when I was born in Crawfordsville, and my parents both are from that area over in western central Indiana. Mm-hmm. And we moved out east because my father was going to seminary. He was a minister. And through a bunch of series of events, we ended back up in Chicago. And I grew up there. We landed there when I was 11 years old, and my life was there except when I was away at school. And then I got offered a one-year teaching replacement job in Muncie, Indiana, and all of a sudden I've just finished my 17th year here, which is just terrifying to think about, right?
Congratulations. Yeah. That's awesome. You were the third guest we've had on the show. We've only had four episodes, and you're the third guest who's had a parent, a pastoral parent in a church.
Yeah, dude, I think there's a lot of PKs in the theater. I don't know why that is, but I think right now on our faculty, there's like three PKs. So it's, I think there's something about that, because church, and I'm not saying this to anybody I'm not saying this in an insulting way. I say it in a beautiful way. Church is theatrical. I think we fall in love with the theater of it. Part of it, church is theatrical.
Yeah.
Very quick, short story. When I was a little girl, My dad was on an ecumenical council in the town we lived in, upstate New York. And one of the things they did, all the pastors and rabbis and priests and everything did on the ecumenical council, was as a group with their families, if they had families, they went to each church or synagogue and we went to services. And so we went to the Reformed Synagogue, and we went to the Catholic Church and saw a high mass, and we went to the Black Baptist Church. And I remember saying to my dad after we'd been, I was like nine, I said, Dad, I'm from the very liberal church, the United Church of Christ, very forward, but very simple services, right? And I remember saying to Dad, why is everybody else's service so much more interesting than ours? Because they were singing, and there was the cantor in the synagogue, and there was all the stuff at mass, and there, you know, it seemed so much more exciting. I should have known I was going to land in theater. I should have known.
I relate to that heavily. I grew up super Catholic. I was like, woo, you train yourself to stay awake.
Yep.
Okay. So what's your earliest memory of theater?
I can tell you exactly. We lived on Cape Cod. My dad had a church there, and he went to seminary in Boston. So when he got assigned a church, he got assigned a church on Cape Cod. And the Cape Playhouse, which is, if you're on the East Coast, it's kind of a well-known summer stock, or it used to be, famous for an old actress named Gertrude Lawrence having worked there. And she was famous, I guess, in the 20s and 30s on Broadway, and she'd go there for the summers. And we went to the Cape Playhouse and saw Camelot. And Camelot. But my dad was, my dad read to us a lot, and he read to us chapter books even when we were young. And one of the books we'd been reading was Once and Future King, which is the Merlin Arthur story.
Yeah.
And he took us to see Camelot. And I was so, we were in one of the boxes in the theater, and I remember by the end of the play, I was down on the floor, lying on my stomach so I could get my face closer to the stage, with my face up to the railing. So my eyes were between the rails, so I was as close to the stage as I could get in that box, watching it, because I couldn't believe it's a little tiny summer stock theater, but to me as a 7-year-old telling this story that I dearly loved, it was the grandeur of it, and the beauty of it, and the music, and the it was just, I'd been transported. And we saw a bunch of plays there in their children's series and everything. We saw other musicals, but Camelot, with all of its problems, is still one of my favorite musicals because of that experience, I was so blown away by the beauty of that. Wow. So that was my first experience. I visited Cape Cod about 4 years ago, and I went to the Cape Playhouse, and I said, I'm in the theater now. I work in the theater. This is the place where I saw my very first play. Can I go look at the theater? And they let me go in and look. And it was a tiny little theater, but it was tiny little proscenium, but it was so great to be in there and remember the feeling of it.
Yeah. You know? Thank you for sharing that. That's so cool.
When theater is what it's supposed to be, it takes us to a different place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you don't forget. You don't forget.
So then when and why or how did you begin directing? When did that become?
I did theater all through high school. I went to this weird hippie school. I describe it as kind of like if Montessori school was a high school, it was kind of like that. They had regular classes, but they also had work at your own speed classes. So you could go into a lab and do your math and then take a test, and that progressed you through your classes. So you could take, it was a weird experimental high school. We didn't get grades. We got evaluations.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was very weird. But I did high school all the way through that, and really, I did theater all the way through high school and really enjoyed that. And then took a couple years off because I graduated early, because I graduated after my junior year. And went to college. My mom and my stepdad are both are retired now, obviously, but we're both psychotherapists. And I was really interested in psychology, and I've read a bunch of psychology, and I got really interested in criminal psychology. I don't know why, I just did. I was interested in what makes people's minds twisted. Mm-hmm. So I was a double major in psychology and criminology, and the dorm I was staying in, the RA was a good RA. You know, every once in a while you get a really good RA.
Yeah.
And she came to me and said, I was reading through your sign-in sheet, and it says you did a lot of theater in high school. Just so you know, the theater department has auditions this week. And so if you're trying to meet people, that might be a place to go. And I went and auditioned. And
yes, Karen.
I got a tiny little part, right? As a maid, and I can't even remember what show, but I was a maid in the first show I did. And you know, it sucked me back in. So yeah. So I called my mom at the beginning of my sophomore year and said, I did it. I switched majors. And she, being the great mom she is, said, good. That's what you wanted to do all along anyway.
Yes, mom.
And yes, mom. And about my junior year, I took my first directing class and I said, holy shit, this is what I should have been doing all along. Because the way I always describe it, and Emil's probably heard me say these words in directing classes, but theater, directing is a macro experience. You're looking at all of it all the time. And you got to flip over and be able to talk micro with an actor or a designer or a playwright even. You have to be able to talk about the specific, but you're doing a 360 degree vision all the time. And it became really clear to me, I was more interested in building the maze instead of walking through it. Does that make sense? I was much more interested in creating the world I found myself when I was acting looking, going, why are they saying that to them there? That would be better if it was over on that part of the stage. And I wasn't being critical. I love puzzles. I think there are many directors you'll find that love puzzles or pattern games or things like that, because we like the idea of that stuff. But I was just a macro person. I was a person who, I wanted to build worlds. I wanted to play God. Directors love to play God.
Amelia, you're shaking your head, yes.
We get to create worlds. And creating worlds is, and you get to live in worlds that you would never get to visit if you were, I mean, you talked about me being over and doing Glengarry Glen Ross in England, and I'm never going to live in an all-male world of skeezy salesmen. Do you know what I mean? There's no way for me to visit that world, because me being there changes that world.
Yeah.
First, because I'm female. Second, because all they'd see me is as a mark. Mm-hmm. Right? So I get to go live in a world, visit a world that I would never get to visit. And I get to build the world. And say, this is what I think it's like. And building worlds and playing God is fun. And it's mostly fun. It's especially fun when it turns out the way you want it to, you know, and you have on stage what you had in your head and it works. I mean, back to one of our big, beautiful musicals. I have to say, when we did Music Man, one of the things that I loved the most was people who came up to me afterwards and said, I really thought I hated this musical, but I really enjoyed it.
Right? Yeah.
And I'm like, excellent. I thought this was a stupid musical, but it was so much fun. I'm like, yes, because I did my work and the actors and the designers did their work. And the world I asked you to join me in was a world that told the story that was entertaining to you and fun. And that's, to me, I get to say, come on into my secret garden. Come on in here and look around. This is how I see the world. I think it can be entertaining and interesting to you.
It gave me goosebumps. I've never thought of the director as a visitor before. That's something I'm going to carry with me. Thank you for that.
Well, and it's a weird mix. I'd be curious to see what Emil has to say about this too, because it's a weird mix, because some of it's visiting and some of it's building. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about directing is if you're doing it right, it's like, you get started and you say, you build that thing over there and I'll come and look at it later. So you're not the only builder. You're the person who oversees it. Yeah. You know, you're the person who oversees your, and then you go, oh, wow, I wouldn't have never thought of doing that detail that way, but it's beautiful. That's great.
Yeah.
So not only you've built the parameters of the world, you've said, mm-hmm. this is where we're going to live. This is how this is going to fit. But an actor will do something that you never imagined. A designer will come up with an idea that you never thought of. Mm-hmm. And what you know as a director is you started the ball rolling, but you're feeding other people in their creativity, and it is the joy of collaborative work. Mm-hmm. The joy of collaborative work is that if I light the spark correctly, people fly with that spark and they buy into the parameters you've built for them, and they create something that you never could have created by yourself.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
And it to me is one of the biggest joys of directing. It really is one of the biggest joys.
The second organization we'd like to highlight is Black Artists Borough. Black Artists Borough is a sixth metaphysical borough of New York City exclusively for Black artists to commune and create. Founded by Akila Ayana, this is a grassroots community-based organization for Black radical creatives and performers who need support, resources, and funding to produce their own creative work. It is a project that aims to revolutionize the way Black people interact with the entertainment industry. Their GoFundMe reads, "It is important now more than ever for Black artists to divest from racist, capitalistic institutions that are built on our backs and exploit our intellectual and creative labor for white consumption. Now is the time to build our own community and catalogs of work for us and by us, to fulfill and indulge in our collective creativity." You can learn more about the borough on Instagram with the handle @BlackArtistsBorough.
The next thing I want to talk about is the role of the director. And we've already touched on that quite a bit. So I'd love to zoom in a little bit on the logistics of everything. Pre-production, post-production, day-to-day stuff. The logistics that a lot of people don't know about, because, you know, I can tell my mom that I'm like assistant directing a local show. And to my mom, she thinks, okay, you're just telling people what to do. Like, so let's...
Which is part of it.
Yeah. So let's start with the basics.
Can I just say something really quick before we start this? Before you talk, the teacher in me has to say this.
Okay.
We're going to talk about it in general. It's different for every single one of us.
Okay.
Yeah. How we approach it and what we do is going to be, it's important that it's different for all of us because we're bringing that thing to it.
Definitely.
So there'll be things that where Emil and I are very much the same, and there's going to be things where we're not the same at all.
Totally. Right?
So I'm sorry, teacher Karen came here. I may have just been being a Karen right then. I'm all right, sorry.
That's okay.
You won't need commercial breaks with us. We do them for ourselves.
Okay, Emil, what does a director actually do? And go. like the logistics. When does the production process start for a director?
In pre-production.
Okay.
Some would say it starts the moment a director has chosen the show to go pitch.
Okay.
It's actually when does the process start for the director? So for me, my process starts. I have two. My career so far has been my process starts when I am designing a season, because I am reading just show after show after show after show, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out financially which one will make sense, what shows I know I can bring actors back to use. It's important to me that I always bring actors back from previous seasons. Mm-hmm. Which ones would be interesting and appealing to my audience that I have at the time. Mm-hmm. Which one will bring in a new audience because I'm still building audience. Which one is the troublemaker? I always like to have a troublemaker show. That's the show where like, I'm not going, this is not for your entertainment. This is for us all to get uncomfortable. So I always try to have one of those shows in there. And so that's my process, right? So all those questions I'm looking at and I'm trying to find a piece. And that's where my process starts there. As I look at to working other theaters, it starts where I'm looking at their seasons and seeing the shows they're interested in and they've done, and then finding pieces that I know may interest them and starting to pitch that. And then you got to get hired. And if you get hired, then it's that pre-production phase, which you're talking to designers about what, you know, what's the budget going to be? How are we going to design this? Here's my vision for the show. What do you have? What do you have to bring in? I'm huge on collaboration. Again, my lineage, I come from a collaborative director. So I too base a lot of my work in collaboration.
Okay.
And so I often come into my rooms stating off at the top, I don't have all the answers, and I am equally relying on you to be a collaborator in this space. I have to ask you to allow me to be an ensemble member just as much as you are going to allow me to be the director.
Sure.
Because there are times in my work and times in art in the work that I make where I go, can I try that? Can I see what that does to me? And it's very cliche because there's a thing in the directing world where people go, we don't like directors that act. We don't like directors that get on the stage. But that's my playground. And it's always been my playground. And I open the space to be a playground. And so nothing is settled until we've all agreed that this works in our playground.
Gotcha.
And that's the building of the world, is building up our playground over and over. And so even with designers have to bring something in. If they don't have a stake in the game, then by the time we get to tech, they're not going to care about the piece. Mm-hmm. They're not going to do that extra magical thing that's going to take what I've done to the next level without me even imagining it. So I've always understood the value of giving everyone a piece of the work. Because when we get to the end, if you do it right, when you get to the end, they're sad you're leaving, right? And they're begging for you to come back because they know. In my final speeches, I always say, I give my show religiously up. It is a tradition. I sit my cast down. I thank them for the process. And I know I've skipped to the end, and there's like stuff we can in between, but Karen can jump into those. But when I get to the end of my process, the night before opening, I sit you down and I tell the cast and crew, thank you for the process. Thank you for this opportunity. Mm-hmm. This show is now the stage manager's. I understand it's not over. I understand you're going to change. I understand you're going to evolve. And eventually this piece will be more than I have ever imagined.
Yeah.
All I tell you is like, don't forget our roadmap. And color the fuck out of it.
Yeah.
Because I can't wait to see what the picture is.
Cool.
And then you have to walk away. Then you have to walk away and you have to let them do the work. And if you are, and this is the privilege, if you're privileged enough to have a long enough run, you get to come back and see truly what the final product is.
Mm-hmm. Is that scary, walking away?
In the beginning, it was, and sometimes there are pieces where you can't. I've had two pieces so far where I've sat in for a piece of the opening show after I do my speech, mm-hmm. or like I can only make it through the first weekend and then I ride out, mm-hmm. and I get to see the rest. Or when it closes, we record all our performances, so when it closes, like I'll just keep watching it, you know, mm-hmm. you know. This Partners is one right now for me that is like, I'm not done with it. I'm so proud of the work it is, but like the possibilities of what this piece is, I'm just like, I'm not done. I know this can be a Chicago show. I know this is going to be an affordable show when things reopen. You know, I'm so ahead right now thinking about the pivot because I got so encouraged when it happened to us. I hope we get to at some point talk about the beauty of COVID, because there is a massive beauty in our art form that COVID has done for us, mm-hmm. that specifically like independent artists have now. Your battlefield has like been leveled out in a way you never could imagine. Yeah. You know, you're not fighting against big houses anymore. Anyone will see or listen to you because there's nothing being done.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we come from this education background where we're studying theorist after theorist after theorist after theorist, and you go, well, like, how the hell did these theorists come? And it goes, right now, like, here's the crisis.
Yeah.
How are you, what are you going to do in the crisis so that you are that person in 20 years when we're looking back and go, man, there goes the next theorist.
Karen, can you speak more to the day-to-day in rehearsal world of a director?
Yeah, and again, all shows are different because mm-hmm. all shows require something different from a director. I mean, directing a Shakespeare with a cast of 20 is very different than directing The Opponent, which was two people and a bunch of boxing that had to happen on stage. So every mm-hmm. play has its own requirements. Part of your job at the beginning is to learn what your how your stage manager works, how your directors, how your actors work, and figure out how you can get your work done with them. Mm-hmm. And how I do it, because it keeps me from getting crazier, I won't say not crazy because I am, but crazier, is I kind of make a plan for what I think I can get done each day. I have a plan. And if I can set it up so I can get done what I have planned, then, like, I know there are directors who will, you've got a 6-hour rehearsal and you get to, you're in a straight six, which is a equity term. For those of you who don't know it, it's a kind of rehearsal. You're in a straight six and you're at 5:30 and you're done. You've done all the work you could do. Mm-hmm. And then directors will just make people do another run through, even though you're done, even though you've achieved your work. I send people home. I know this is true about actors because I've learned it. Actors don't want to do busy work. And to do another run through just because we can, when everybody's tired, and or in that thing that happens with actors as they're trying to process, everybody's full and they need processing time. So the run through is just because you've got the half an hour and you feel like you should do something, as opposed to, am I comfortable with where we are? Are we where we should be? And then if we are, I go home. And then sometimes you don't get there and you're at the full six and you go, fuck, I didn't get everything done. And then you have to rework tomorrow's rehearsal and you have to figure out where you can steal time.
Yeah.
My wonderful professor that when I was in grad school, his name is Dick Trousdell, and just a lovely, wonderful person. One of my questions was, but how much rehearsal time do you need? And he goes, however much you have. And you don't know what that means, because in school, you've got the luxury of these 5 and 6 and 7 and 8-week rehearsal processes. And you get to professional theater and all of a sudden you're doing something in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, and like, what? Yeah, exactly. But then you learn to work fast.
Yes.
So things expand and contract depending on how much time you have. But always, always, I believe there are directors who don't agree with me, and it's absolutely their prerogative. I believe that the two thing actors need in order to get to a really comfortable place with the show is they need to have a sense of flow of the show. So you need to offer them, if not full run-throughs, you need to offer them run-throughs of sections, offer them run-throughs of acts, so they get the feeling of the show going through.
Yeah.
So I build my rehearsal schedule around making sure we are at least running sections, so they get before we get to tech. There are lots of directors who will get to tech and have never done a run-through. And because I have so many actors who are friends, I know how irritating that is to them, to not know how the show works and not know and have never had a chance to piece together their arc of their performance. So I feel like my job in rehearsal is to get my work done, but also to make sure the actors are giving them the thing that will allow them ownership of their role, which is Definitely. To truly understand the arc of the show, to truly understand their part in it, and to get them that place. So my rehearsal schedules are geared around making sure we get to that place. Mm-hmm. Because I always feel like my happy place is when I can see the show in the last run through in the rehearsal space. Then I know we can go into tech, and whatever happens, if tech blows up, if tech is a freaking disaster, and it happens, if tech is a disaster, I know the show is living. Because I saw it living in a bare room in fluorescent lights. Mm-hmm. So I know the actors know the show. I know I saw the show. We just have to slap the lipstick on it. Right?
Yep.
And then we can get to where we need to get to. So my goal always is to make sure that last run through in the rehearsal space, or that last run through before tech starts, that the show lives then. I think that's my job. So you put the pieces together in such a way that you're not asking actors to do busy work, but you're getting done everything you need to get done.
Gotcha. Thank you. Two episodes ago, we had a panel of theater and university leaders on the show to talk about the logistics of running a theater organization. And we briefly spoke about what it costs to mount a season. And we touched on that a little bit today as well. I like to talk about the financial aspect of theater because I don't think many people in or outside of the business know specifically like the different financial lives that a show takes on. So can either of you speak to how much money a director makes and how, when, and why that varies?
Emil and I are from very different worlds in terms of his professional, because they're producing for profit. Mm-hmm. The Chicago theater world is mostly a non-for-profit world.
Mm-hmm. Right? Is this a Red Orchid theater as well?
This is Red Orchid, most theaters. Okay. Most theaters in Chicago are non-for-profit theaters, meaning they have a board, they get grants, they have personal grants and foundational grants and civic grants and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Which is not to say some professional for-profit theaters they get grants as well, but it's not the same thing. Pay is usually based on the size of the place. Pay is usually based on, I've made as much as $20,000 for a show, and I've been paid $500 for a show. And the $500 shows were not a long time ago. Some of them have been really recent because luckily I am now a professor. I've got income. I've got insurance. Mm-hmm. I can do a show in a small theater that I really want to direct with actors I really want to direct because I don't have to pay my bills with it. I made better money when I was freelance and having to pay my bills because I had to take the jobs that would pay my bills. Mm-hmm. Now I pretty much direct what I want and I don't have to make much money because my theater job is paying my mortgage. I mean, my teaching job is paying my mortgage.
Gotcha.
My teaching job is, and you will find there are very, very few professional directors who are not either artistic directors of theaters or professors of theater somewhere, because it is very hard to make a living as a director unless you are a regular Broadway director or up the level of Lort, where you're making, it is very hard to make that kind of money.
For those of you who don't know, Lort is an acronym that stands for League of Regional Theaters.
Mm-hmm. And you have to be working for the A's and the A pluses to be making that kind of money, right? Mm-hmm. And then they're ranked, the A and the A plus are, there's levels of Lort, and that's the highest level. And that's where you're going to be making the biggest money. And it's just, I was a stupid artist when I started, and I'm like, I don't care about making money. I just want to make art. And the world of Chicago led me to that because it's so much about, you don't ask about where you are on the ladder, you ask about who you're working with.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that is a Chicago ethos. It's one of the reasons I love the city's theater community so much. It's about what am I doing?
Yeah.
And with whom am I doing it? Not what am I making or who's seeing me. So, and it's just lots of people don't know how different the ways of producing are. And that's, so I make all sorts of different amounts of money, but sometimes I work for almost nothing because I love the play, and I'm happy to do it. I work for almost nothing.
I love that. That makes me hopeful. Emil, in today's market, right? You are obviously the executive artistic director of Marietta's New Theater in the Square, but when you're directing for a different theater, how does a director get a job? Like, actors have to audition, but how do directors get jobs?
It's about relationship. It's the relationship of going to see our theater company's productions and mm-hmm. being in their rooms. It's about sitting down and talking to artistic directors or other leaders of that company, mm-hmm. and investing in that with your time and your mm-hmm. artistry, and then it's the pitching. It's the artistic director saying, "All right, give me some shows." You have to the important thing is you have to figure out when artistic directors are planning their season. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest hook. You can't fish if you don't know when the fish are out, right? So you have the first thing for you to do is figure out, okay, this is the season when this is the time period of the year when they're looking for shows. This is when they're announcing shows, right? And the easiest way to really do it is to go like, look at their season announcement mm-hmm. and go within 8 to 12 months of that time.
Okay.
That's when you're choosing.
6 months.
Nope. You're choosing season back, always.
Yeah. Always
far back, it sounds like.
Far back. Mm-hmm. Because especially nonprofits, they're planning their seasons years in advance. Years in advance. I mean, look at what just happened. The reason why they shut down wasn't just because of the virus, it was because they had to do the first thing that they promised to get the money, mm-hmm. and then the second thing, and if they can't do, they have to actually stop the whole product.
Yeah.
We also don't want people to die in our theater.
That too.
Yes. Yes.
That would also be a choice.
Mega bummer.
That also is a choice.
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, I would say in my training, I'm hearing, you know, don't be scared to assistant direct. If you're comfortable being an assistant director, do it, you know, be smart about it. Don't make that a career. But do it to get into the room, and then you need to speak up for yourself when you're ready to do the work.
It's kind of like being an assistant director is kind of like being an understudy. It's great to do it once to meet people, but you don't want to get people, you don't want to allow people to know you that way for any length of time, right? And you have to be really careful that you're assistant directing people who can help you,
yeah.
and who will essentially say, you know, there's a young director I know who's ready for an opportunity. I can't direct the play you just offered me, but I know somebody. If you don't, I know somebody who would be really good for you, and that's who you're looking. That's who you're looking to assist. Just like that's who you're looking to understudy for. As theaters will think of you that way.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Illuminating. Now I have a series of rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Here we go.
Ready.
All right. Emil, what makes a good director?
A collaborator, someone who listens, someone who is fearless, someone who is boisterous, someone who uses their heart and not just their soul or their mind. Me.
Karen, what's something about the job most people don't know?
I think the prep time where you are by yourself in your head trying to figure out the play, how much of this is private. The same teacher who said to me how much rehearsal, when I asked him how much rehearsal time, said however much you had, used to call it the secret art form, because there is so much that happens in our head before we talk to anybody. We're reading the script and we're thinking before you write a word down, I used to actually enjoy the time when I was directing professionally in Chicago, but down here in Muncie, I used to enjoy the time I was driving because it gave me 3.5 hours of thinking time. Mm-hmm. And I could sit and plan my rehearsal and think through the part of the play I was working on as I was driving. I wouldn't turn on the radio. I'd turn my phone off so I couldn't hear it ring. And I would just think, because there is so much work we do in our brains that nobody else knows about.
Emil, what's a project you would love to direct someday?
Oh, shit. Come on, man. there's not a project I would love to create. I would love to own the Black Broadway in the South.
Woo! Karen,
what? For you. Can I direct the Black Broadway in the South?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can.
I'm always going to Shakespeare. Because I love Shakespeare, I'm always going to go to Shakespeare and say, right now, my top of my bucket list is Lear, because I haven't had a chance to do it and would love to do it. I'm going to shock everybody by saying a musical and say, I've always wanted to do Ragtime, and I love that show so much. I love that show and I love what it says and I love the music and I love it. And the final thing I think I would say is any cool new original script, there is nothing I like better than working on new plays. Nothing I like better than that, except for maybe Shakespeare. There is nothing I like better than new plays.
Emil, who are some directors whose work you admire?
Ooh, Karen Kessler. Anne Bogart. Robert O'Hare. Lisa Portes. Mm-hmm. Sid Prather, who is a young director here in Georgia coming up. She's amazing, has her own little tiny theater company. It's interesting you asked that because I've been looking a lot at the George Wolfs and the Lloyd Richards. Because in my study now for my master's, I'm really looking at the lineage of black male, black mm-hmm. American directors, because mm-hmm. there isn't text written on that. So I used to fight everyone because they always made me study white men. And then I got to the point where I was like, well, where the hell is the book that I can slap them in the face with and go like, why aren't you giving it to me? And it doesn't actually exist. So my process in grad school has been beginning this research so that this lineage gets created so that actually be the change we want.
So he can write the book.
Yeah, I'm going to write the book.
Someday.
Hell yes, Emil.
He will. Hell yes, he'll write that book.
I'm writing the book because what did Karen say? Most directors are artistic directors, professors. Right.
Hell yes, he'll write that book.
Karen, did you meet Margaret Atwood when you did Alias Grace?
I did not, but here's the coolest thing about Margaret Atwood. When we were doing it down, because we did it in Chicago, and then we did it down at Clarence Brown in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is Lord Theater, as we mentioned here. I love the callbacks. And Brenda, who was playing Grace down at Clarence Brown, tweeted, and she included Margaret Atwood in the tweet, and Margaret Atwood retweeted us, and we were so excited. We were so excited that she had retweeted the production. So yeah, unfortunately, we were hoping we would get to meet her in Chicago, and it just didn't work out because she was there for the Humanities Festival, and it just didn't work out. But you know, in some ways, I think I would have just been a blithering idiot. So it's better that I didn't, and I would be apologizing. And Jen Blackmore, who wrote the adaptation, mm-hmm. and I were both like, "Are you okay? What do we do about this?" But it was we did not get to, unfortunately.
One day.
One day.
The last organization we'd like to highlight is Artists Against Racism, or AAR. AAR is a private Facebook group whose mission statement reads, "We exist to eradicate hate, racism, and prejudice from our industries in order to create the world we wish to see, and to amplify marginalized and oppressed voices." In the past several weeks I've been on it, it has served as a place for theater artists and teachers to hold each other accountable, ask each other questions, and share stories, articles, and discourse. If you would like to join the conversation in AAR, feel free to send them a request or email us for an invite at lyingawakepodcast@gmail.com. Or you can reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram with the handle @lyingawake.podcast.
Okay, so this segment is called Past and Future. I want to talk about how theater's changed and consider how it's changing right now. So Karen, the first credit listed on your LinkedIn says associate artist in 1993. Is that correct? Is that the year that you really began
in
the...
Okay. Yep, that's how old I am. I'm actually older than that. I lie about my age all the time.
I don't lie,
I just don't tell. All right, go ahead.
So from your perspective, what are some ways that the theater has changed from that date to today?
Two pieces that are big to me. And one is when I started, you guys, it was still hard for women. And one of the reasons I've really loved Chicago is because there's a history of women leading theaters and female directors. I used to say, the great thing about Chicago was even in the 90s and the early 2000s, without thinking, I could make a list of 5 or 10 really terrific female directors that work constantly. And that was different than a lot of cities. I think I read an article about New York directors, New York finally allowing, not allowing, but finally embracing female directors. And that was like at the end of the 20-aughts, you know, and I'm like, what? Wow. But, you know, and so I was part of another generation of female directors that said, no, we're here, we're going to direct, we're here, and we're going to do this. And so I love that. And now we're in this new place where we are, every business is looking at the world in a different way right now and realizing that we are a multicultural world, and we are, to do our work right and to live our lives right, we have to be inclusive. And that started before all of the protests happened and before the heinousness in terms of dead Black men in the street, which is horrifying. And it started before that, but it's really supercharged it. And people are having conversations about how things have to change. Now, I'm not a Pollyanna. I don't believe this is all going to change right away. I don't believe that. I believe a lot of people will talk a good game, and when it becomes expedient to do it a different way, they may. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw what happened at Victory Gardens in Chicago, and it was ugly, and it was big, and this was a company that was dedicated to an inclusive world, and evidently the board was not as dedicated to that as the people who ran the theater. So, sure. I'm not... It has its ups and downs, but I think we've made huge steps. I'm really hopeful right now because being Black is a good thing for Emil right now. He will get jobs because he is, and he will get to direct plays that aren't just written by August Wilson or Susie Laurie Parks. And that's the thing to me, is it's like, you know, all my Black friends who are directors, like, I'm like, okay, where are you directing in February? Because it's Black History Month, and they would always have a job in February and no other time. And it's like, and so now I believe, and it used to be the women directing the comedies and the musicals while the men would direct the serious plays, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, we're breaking through those lines. We're breaking through them. And I have no illusions this will be fast or easy, but we see the things we have to break.
Yeah.
And not just the people who have been punished by those borders see those lines. We all, those of us who are women who couldn't get anything but the comedy, the musical, saw those lines. Those of us who are Black directors who couldn't see anything but getting what August Wilson you wanted me to direct in February.
Sure.
You know what I mean? We mm-hmm. always saw those lines, but the world is starting to see those lines. Mm-hmm. And some people are going to defend those lines. Some people are going to draw those lines as hard as they can draw them. But I do see at least those of us who have had to break through some lines, those of us who still have lines to break through, are, I think, being allies to each other and saying, we're not standing for this. And we may have to batter away at this for a long time, but we'll batter.
Yeah.
We'll keep battering at it until we win. Until there is no rule about who gets to be a director.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great to hear you. That's one of the reasons I wanted to ask this question. Just to my personal experience coming into theater was theater was a haven for me. Theater was a place where I could sort out what and who I was, and also do this thing that made me feel my fullest self, right? But I didn't have any awareness of the history. I didn't have any awareness of the lines that you spoke of, the people who have seen the lines and who haven't. And so talking about it now and thinking about the way that I viewed theater back when I first started, it's baffling to me that something that was such a safe place and such a place of people coming together has this long history of discrimination, just like every business in our country does.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not absolutely, and I will say this to you. The mm-hmm. fact is the world has been run by white men.
Yeah.
The world has been run by white men.
Yeah.
And women have been pounding at it in their way, and BIPOC folks have been pounding at it in their way, but the world has been run by white men, and theater is part of that world.
Yeah.
So it's not shocking.
Yeah.
Not shocking that, that men ran white. I mean, if you get online right now and go look at the artistic directors of Lort theaters all across the country, mm-hmm. the biggest percentage of them are going to be white men. And mm-hmm. it's the idea and faculties. Do you know how many white male directors there are out teaching dinosaurs? I mean, I'm a freaking dinosaur, but white male directors who learned in the 60s and have no business, they have no knowledge of theater now, but mm-hmm. they've become entrenched in a place where they're not moving forward. They still think we need to do the canon. Which Williams or Miller play are we going to do this time? And white man's going to direct it? And I'm sorry, I get really heated about this, but I feel really strongly.
Absolutely.
And if I never see another Miller play, I will be fine. And the only reason I would see a Miller play is if Emile directed it, or a BIPOC woman directed it, or somebody who can tell me something different. Mm-hmm. Because Miller was a misogynist. His women were either helpmate mommies or sexual objects. He was a misogynist, but we revere his plays. And I'm like, yes, you know what? He's a brilliant writer. That doesn't mean he wasn't a misogynist.
Sure.
You know, Mamet, brilliant writer. Asshole. I'm sorry, David Mamet, if you're listening to this podcast, I believe that. And I've directed one of your plays. So the hard part is going to be not just the resistance from white men who don't want to give up their power, because nobody gives up power willingly. Nobody in the history of mankind has given up power willingly. The problem is that we're going to have to get, when we get to the after times of this battle, we're going to have to figure out how we live together.
Yeah.
How we live together. So that when August Wilson said to Robert Brustein, no, I don't want a white man directing my play, that has to be okay. And it has to be okay for a young Latinx playwright to say, I don't care who directs my play, as long as it's somebody who's aware. All of our opinions have to be okay at some point in the aftertime, as long as we're being inclusive. That's a long way away. I may not see it. I'm old. I may not get there.
Mm.
Right? But we're moving in that direction. And this whole horror that started around George Floyd's death, I'm being very careful how I choose my words here. The positive in this is the protest and the idea that we are going to say we will not live like this anymore.
Mm.
Starting with the ugliness of we will not be okay with police shooting black men or black women in Breonna Taylor's case. But also we are not going to live with shrugging our shoulders over what white men do.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to say, this is changing, and white men, get on board or get out of the way because it's changing.
Yeah.
And so that's my.
Thank you for that, Karen.
Yeah.
Emile, in your speech before partners and on social media after, you talked about how Marietta's New Theater in the Square is an Afro-Latino owned and operated company, and how important it is to support theater made by Black, Indigenous, and people of color. No doubt then that you're aware of the recent BIPOC artist coalitions such as Black Artists Bureau and We See You White American Theater calling for just what Karen was talking about, an overhaul in the funding, production, and consumption of American theater with an emphasis on anti-racism. Mm-hmm. So with all this in mind, I just want to give you a chance to speak to your hopes for the future. In an ideal world where you got to choose every aspect therein, what are your hopes for not only New Theater in the Square and theaters with similar missions? And if you can check out Theater in the Square's mission statement on their site, it's beautiful and inspiring as hell. But for the whole of theater the theater industry in the United States, your hopes for the future?
My hope is that there's a lot of hopes. One, I hope that everyone is has a seat at the table, and I hope that everyone who has a seat at the table understands the responsibility of having a seat at the table, and uses that seat as a starting point for everyone who comes before them and everyone who should come after them. I think one of my many biggest issues with theater is that I feel like it stopped after the Great Depression. Like, I feel like that was our last big hoorah. We lost everything, and then the government said, here's a way for your industry to continue, to re-merge. And everyone jumped on that bandwagon, rightly so at the time. But now we're 100 years later, and nothing has changed in that industry. Meanwhile, TV has gone from non-existent to black and white to color to HD to HD 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we're still doing the same thing.
Yeah.
The same thing in just one lifetime. And so my hope is that we just understand that storytelling changes because the time changes. I hope that less theaters go into the not-for-profit market, specifically black institutions and ethnic institutions. That is not a network that was made for us, that is created to benefit us. And so spending time over there just gets you further and further away from your goals. But at the same time, I hope that white individuals and equally ethnic individuals stop supporting white institutions that are doing the same thing over and over, and that we get back to the exploratory of going to a new theater and seeing a new piece of work, mm-hmm. And traveling. Like, that had always been my love for Chicago, was that you can literally land in Chicago at any point of the day and guarantee yourself that night you could be in a theater seat.
Yeah.
Like, that has literally been the truth of Chicago as long as I've known it and as long as I've heard artists talk about it. And to be able to do that means that people are cycling dozens and dozens of theaters. They're not just going to the same theater every day. And so when you get to have a drink with a director there or an artist there, you know, you got to really have seen some stuff to talk to them, because they'll blow your mind. Because they will jump from theater to theater, from show to show, to season, because like many enjoy going to a movie. That's fine. I love movies too. But as many enjoy going to movies, there is still a large population that loves sitting in the seats and having a live experience, mm-hmm. of humans trying to figure out how to come to a form of peace. The biggest thing. We're always trying to find peace. I don't know how, but that's our thing. Right? As humans who won't find peace, we just keep searching for it. So I hope that people retire. The bonus is a COVID, right? Rest in peace to all that we have lost dearly. I don't want that to go ignored, right? But the beauty of COVID is, if you up there, it's time for you to retire. If you already have your pension, if you already done your years, you know, it's time to sit down and consider your last pivot. May that be going back to a company and directing yearly. If that goes to, you need to write your books. You know, I think there's a lot that artists aren't doing that we have a responsibility to doing. One of those things is, if you're a director and you are finishing off a career without a book, I think you have forgotten why you became a director. Because what we were studying in the beginning were playwrights and directors' studies and their work. And so how can we consider ourselves to be a part of this lineage if, when you're done with your career, no one's going to be able to go back and go, here's how I would make a block, an X-name director's work, which is what the study of directing is. How would you be able to do this based off of what they said their work is, until you get that opportunity? I hope that the youth is not terrified of what tomorrow is, and that they can see themselves on stage and see the stories that need to be told. And I pray that people are listening, and I hope that it is still my calling to be a part of that evolution of theater that is going to happen before I die.
Beautifully said. Thank you, Emil.
Thanks, John.
The last question I have for the two of you is, what does theater mean to you? It's a question that we ask all of our guests. It can be as simple or as complex, as personal or impersonal as you'd like it to be. Just a simple prompt. Karen Kessler, what does theater mean to you?
This is a hard question, only in that it would be very easy to say something glib. But the fact is that theater is my life's work. And it is telling stories with human beings, with other human beings, and in a space where we share our energy as we tell the story. So it's the alternating current of actors and audience. Telling stories, the humanity of that is, it's life reflecting art, reflecting life, right? And it's the thing I love, and when it works, it is spiritual. In a very real way, when it works, it is spiritual. And it can be spiritual in the way you laugh so hard that everything is released for a while, or it can, you cry so hard that you are someplace, that you are someplace different. Something cathartic happens. And what I love about the theater and why it's my life's work is because in that place of telling stories, I get to be both my best self and my questing self and my youngest self who liked to play dress up and who laid in that theater and watched Camelot and saw the glory of it. And all of those people get to be inside of me while I do my work, and I have something that I can give. I have something I can give. And it makes me happy.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Emil Thomas, what does theater mean to you?
It is the thing that I have dedicated my life to. And it is my playground. It has always been my playground.
Yes.
It's always.
That's such a good word, because it is true. It is a playground.
Mm. It is the playground, and in the playground, you know, it's, as a kid, you get to imagine going to places you never will be able to go. You get to see the future. You get to see the past. You create storylines. You create dialogue. You create conflict, resolutions, which are usually your parents yelling at you to stop, but. You know, it is one of the first things you learn about society is that there is a place where we all come to play. And I fell in love with that place the first time I was able to go to one. And I have dedicated my life to continuing to find a place where people can all come together and play. It is for me my responsibility to tell the stories of those who have come before me. It is my duty to present work that is the change that I talk so highly about, and at the end of the day, it's my meditation when I can't sit still.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I can't say nothing other than, like, pandemic happened and I ran home to my theater. Because mm-hmm. I couldn't sit still.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that if all of us had a space that we could have run to, all artists would have ran into that space and we would have been in there until we were able to sit still.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. I just want to thank you both so, so much for giving your time and your minds and your hearts so generously. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure to do it with you. And it's also been a pleasure to spend the time with Emil too, because I love him. I love you. It's been great to do it.
I love you right back.
It was the best.
Yay.
It was the best start of my day. So thank you so much, guys.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm so glad. Are there any final, are there any plugs for projects, anywhere you'd like to be reached on the interwebs, anything like that?
I'm writing a book, just so we know.
Ooh.
my first book, I'm in the middle of writing a book about how you cut Shakespeare. So people, new directors will know how to pick up a play and cut it.
Because she cuts the shit out of Shakespeare.
Yeah, and I got a believe it or not, a musical I'm writing. So what? I'm in writing mode right now because there's no directing to be done.
Wow.
So I'm writing.
When can people look forward to seeing the first glimpses of these projects?
I'm hoping we're going to do a workshop of a musical sometime this coming up year. Sometime. Okay. It's a Americana musical that I'm writing with my sister, who's a brilliant country and bluegrass and blues musician.
Wow.
And hopefully at least the first act is close to being ready to be looked at by people. And the book is almost in process and it's going to start editing. So hopefully within the next year. Books take a long time. So it's just good to get through the process. But I hope we'll see where we are.
All right. I'm going to flood your inbox with my vocal reel to submit for your musical. And Emil, any projects, any plugs, any connections?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram at Emil Thomas. On Facebook too at Emil Thomas. Follow my theater, Marietta's New Theater in the Square at theaterinthesquare.net or Marietta's Theater in the Square on Instagram or Facebook as well, if that's how you are. Stay tuned. This is going to be interesting. I am right now trying to figure out how to finish off the year. So I've created a mold of creating, I've been able to create a mold in the facility of doing live theater virtually. And we've gotten a lot of great feedback about it. And so now I am in the beginning stages of figuring out how can I now do this for the next 5-6 months until we'll be able to really go back to true capacity. Mm-hmm. But make sure that theater is happening in the nation, because I'm not looking at the city anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So,
cool.
Yeah, follow me.
Wow, what an episode. I successfully have nodes. Alex, come back. There are an incredible number of resources and articles online to learn about what's happening right now in the theater industry and why. So please, when you have some time, check it out. Or if you don't know where to start, email us at lyingawakepodcast@gmail.com. We'll put together some resources for you to explore at your leisure. But the sooner the better. You can also find us on Facebook by searching for us, and on Instagram with the handle @lyingawake.podcast. Alex will be back next episode, where this time we'll be talking about making theater from the perspective of some very special guest music directors. You won't want to miss it. Thank you for nerding out with me on all things theater. I'm John Arlen Baines, and I'll be here next time you find yourself lying awake.